right, Mr. Keith, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm John Keith. Jessica Sura and I represent the appellant Paul Lee and his solely owned company, Strategic Healthcare, which we call SHC. Mr. Lee and Ms. Bowden divorced in 2010. They entered a property settlement agreement that was called a term sheet. It spelled out lots of obligations really to be performed by SHC, including hiring Ms. Bowden for an indefinite period of time for a large salary. Ms. Bowden had the right, since that term sheet was incorporated into the decree, she had the right from the day after the decree was entered to enforce it by going in for a rule to show cause if it were violated. In 2013, however, she chose to sue her ex-husband and SHC for breaching the term sheet in a contract and action. We filed a demurra, when we filed that demurra, the trial judge advised Ms. Bowden that a better vehicle for the case would be going back to the divorce case for a rule to show cause, and entered an order to that effect.
Can I interrupt you there? Was it? I mean, everyone talks about this order as a bifurcation order. It's just a stay order, right? Just stayed the law action while a parallel, completely independent action went forward.
Your Honor, it actually didn't even stay the action. It simply it said in the order that Ms. Bowden had 30 days within which to file it for a rule to show cause. Of course, if she hadn't done it within 30 days, she wouldn't have lost the right to do it if she'd done it before the suit.
But you don't file rights to show cause in a breach of contract action in circuit court. That's a completely different proceeding.
That's correct.
So why is the word bifurcation even used in this case? There's no bifurcation at all.
We never used it, and I agree with you completely. It was not a bifurcation in our opinion. It was.
Did the trial judge use that term at any point?
Not as far as I recall, or based on my review of the record, that term was never used.
So that's a characterization of the order. That's not actually the order.
It is indeed. I think that the judge was motivated to enter that order because she wanted to further the ends of judicial economy, and she thought that it would save the clients a lot of time and money. Take it back to the divorce case, get a quick ruling on a rule to show cause. I don't believe for a second that it was her intent to allow her to have a try in the divorce case, and if she lost, then have a second bite of the apple back in the contract case. So Ms. Bowden went back to the divorce case. She filed a petition covering virtually every point that was involved in the breach of contract action. The similarities are quite striking. We have outlined them in our brief at pages 16 to 18. The rule to show cause was heard by a different trial judge, Judge Brody, for the better part of two full days. She found there was no contempt because there was no violation of the term sheet. And Judge Brody's order is in the joint appendix at page 197 to 199.
So now, her contempt proceeding obviously has a different sort of standard that applies to it than a breach of contract action. So if her ruling was he's not in contempt because it wasn't willful, that'd be one thing. But what you're telling the court is that the ruling was there was not a breach of the contract, consequently he's not in contempt.
I believe that's exactly what she ruled. She might have given a ruling that wouldn't have been useful in terms of arguing res judicata, But her ruling was a fulsome ruling on the merits.
So that tell me where I'll find that in the appendices.
It's page 197 to 199. And it came after a long, lengthy hearing with witnesses and many exhibits.
In fact, Counsel, let me point you to, on page 197, the court finds that there has been no willful contempt or violation of the provisions of the final order. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Start the second paragraph.
That's correct.
So if it didn't have the second part, you would concede that there's no res judicata because the standards aren't the same. But because there's the alternative ruling that there is no breach of this contract, same parties, same issues, and that's your position.
Yes, Your Honor. Because there's no breach of the final order incorporates the contract in full. So it's exactly the same contract, and it's the same ruling. And if you look at the rulings and the similarities between the pleadings, there is no doubt that the same issues were in play. It's the same cause of action as we now know that the cause of action is defined.
So the 11 findings of fact that follow that disjunctive are all findings of fact having nothing to do with willfulness for contempt purposes, but rather the presence or absence of rights under the contract.
That's correct. There's absolutely, I don't think there's any finding of willfulness or lack of willfulness. I mean, for example, the judge could have said, I think that Mr. Lee violated it, but I don't think it was willful. And therefore, I find no contempt.
The judge could say, I don't really know exactly what the contract means or doesn't mean, but whatever it means, there was no willful violation of it.
That's correct, Justice Kelsey, and she had no trouble with interpreting this contract. She did not for a second find it to be ambiguous or indefinite. She went right down the points and ruled on every one, and of course an important one is in paragraph 2. SAC owns the property at 1010 Pepper Tree Lane, Sarasota, Florida, and has the right to sell the property. That's pretty clear cut.
Would you address the issue of privity to the extent that you all agreed in the show cause proceeding that SHC was not a party to the term agreement?
Justice Powell, I don't think there was ever any question that Mr. Lee and SHC were in privity. We essentially stipulated that they were the alter egos of one another. It was a solely owned corporation. It was pleaded that way against Mr. Lee and SHC, and rather than fight it, Mr. Lee and SHC went with it. They granted it and said, yes, you're right. We are essentially one and the same. So I don't think there could be any real question about privity in this case.
Well, in the contempt proceeding, the wife's counsel specifically alleged that SHC was a party to the term sheet.
That's correct. And in fact, the term sheet contains virtually every obligation in the term sheet is an obligation of SHC.
So Mr. Lee is the sole shareholder and the only officer.
That's correct.
So if you were to call the corporation in the court, he'd be the person that shows up.
That's absolutely correct. I think that the cause of action in this case, the transaction or occurrence or the definable factual transaction is simply the question of was this term sheet violated? And that there were two bites at the apple in this case. The rule to show cause rulings we submit should have been given preclusive effect as to all facts that were in existence at the time the First Amendment complaint was filed.
So you would concede, though, Mr. Keith, I assume, that contractual claims that did not accrue had not ripened for purposes of enforcement at the time of the show cause would not be covered by collateral estoppel. In theory, they'd be covered by claim preclusion under res judicata, but the collateral estoppel aspect of res judicata would not cover that, those subsequent claims. Am I right?
I think that's correct. If the facts weren't in existence, and you've turned your question in terms of accruing, the cause of action accruing, but it is true that at the time the First Amendment complaint was filed, not all of the facts that were in existence. In other words, the property had not yet been sold.
So if there were some unaccrued cause of action that collateral estoppel would not shut down anyway because of a predicate finding, that in theory would not be covered by claim preclusion.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Our second assignment of error deals with the our position that the trial court erred in not allowing Mr. Lee to explain his sale of the property. He was not allowed to explain that SHC didn't sell that property down in Florida until after they'd received Judge Brody's order. The trial judge agonized over this a little bit. That at one point, he at page 573 of the joint appendix, he says, "Well, how can I, be fair to both sides here?" But
if res judicata in its claim preclusion form applies, that would moot this issue, would it not?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Lee and the appellants had their hands tied behind their backs and allowed Ms. Bowden to argue that SHC and Lee had no right to sell the house. They sold it in bad faith and that it was a breach of trust. And it was a complete sort of a tarring of Mr. Lee that was we were unable to defend against. It was highly prejudicial, and we feel that we should have had the opportunity, it was error to exclude that. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. Daniel Barks for the appellee, Lisa Spoden. If I might first, before I get started, address briefly in order one of the arguments that was put forth and asked by the court, and that is the argument of privity in regards to SHC and Mr. Lee. Initially in Mr. Lee's answer, in defendant's answer, they pled that there was no obligation of SHC under the term sheet.
But privity law doesn't require parties to be on the same contract. Privity is a whole different concept.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. However, in their answer to the amended complaint, they went on to say that they had fulfilled all of their requirements of the term sheet and at the same time had no duties under the term sheet.
Right, but whether someone's a party to a contract or not a party to a contract is relevant, but not even arguably dispositive, as to whether they are in privity with someone who is a party to it.
Yes, Your Honor. We would agree with that, and that's why we continue to bring the action against SHC. I just wanted to correct that when they declared that
well, that's
they
a
word
of a concession you just made. If you made it, if there is privity, that ends the whole privity issue for purposes of res judicata.
It ends the whole privity issue of res judicata, Your Honor, assuming that Judge Brody had subject matter jurisdiction to go beyond simply the contempt hearing. And that's, I think, where we begin from our argument, Your Honor.
But not for collateral estoppel. Collateral estoppel is fact preclusion within the umbrella of res judicata, and the qualification you just made, which is arguable anyway, but the qualification you just made is not a qualification to fact preclusion. It's only a qualification to claim preclusion.
Well, and I believe Your Honor is looking at 1-6 and how it has been brought forth since it was adopted. And we would certainly agree with the court's definition there of what that includes. However, we have a different standard. We have a very simple issue in a rule to show cause hearing where the court is looking at whether or not, without defining under when, without defining under Shabesky, what is in that contract, what is in that term sheet, whether or not it's been violated. And that, of course, makes sense because we're looking for a very harsh remedy to the defendant in this case. We would say that under Shabelsky, under various cases that this court has read, Lloyd, and also under Morrison, that she did not have subject matter jurisdiction to determine anything.
She couldn't determine whether or not the contract, which was incorporated by reference into her order, which made it a court-ordered contract, what the contract said and who breached it. She didn't have jurisdiction to do that.
She has jurisdiction to determine if the contract is clear.
She said it was. What's next?
And if there was a breach of it.
She said there wasn't.
And so that is what we were looking for in the area of a rule to show cause. But that doesn't get us into the full litigation. It doesn't get us
counsel, to the extent that she perhaps got into the full litigation and made various factual findings. Did you at any point object to those factual findings on the order that was entered?
In the record, Your Honor, which is not before this court right now, we did object during the hearing to the order. We did not object. We do not feel we needed to object because this court has determined if you go beyond your subject matter jurisdiction, it is null and void in any of
this. So follow that through. I know this is a big point. Maybe I'm misunderstanding you. If I'm a trial court and hearing a show cause and the property settlement agreement is incorporated but not merged into the final agreement,
yes, Your Honor.
You would tell me I don't have subject matter jurisdiction to read the property settlement agreement and find out if somebody violated it after I ordered them to not violate it?
The rule in... Yes, Your Honor, of course. That's and sorry to go around your question, but yes, absolutely, that's the point of a rule to show cause. There's no disagreement there. The issue is, does the court have the ability to dig into under when and under its progeny, dig into whether or not the terms are clear or not. The court is looking at whether or not on its face it is clear, and if there was a violation. Again, that simplistic look at it is important because we're talking about just looking at whether there's been a violation. We can't go into parole evidence in a rule to show cause hearing, and the judge is very clear on that.
Why can't you do that if it's ambiguous? If there's a PSA that's ambiguous, and it's on a contempt hearing in a show cause, and the ambiguity would otherwise, under full evidence rule, require extrinsic evidence. You're telling me that the law says that a litigant can't bring extrinsic evidence into a show cause hearing to say, it's ambiguous, I meant X, other side meant not X. How can you say I violated it?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying you can't bring that in. What I'm saying is that under the rule of show cause hearing, as we had it here, the judge looked at the very basic issues of whether it was clear and whether there was a violation. We had issues of fact. We had questions of fact. And one of those was whether or not SHC was a party to this. And as Judge Nordland said in her demur here...
Can I interrupt one more time?
Yes, sir.
If what you're saying, as I'm hearing it, is that the show cause is a completely different subject matter jurisdiction from the breach of contract, that's your argument. I'm not agreeing to it, but that's your argument. Then how did... Why do you keep calling the breach of contract order a bifurcation order? You don't bifurcate something that's not within your jurisdiction.
Correct, Your Honor, and I think that's a characterization.
But it's an important characterization because a court can order that parallel litigation go forward without res judicata effect, and that is one of your arguments in your brief. A court can order under res judicata law that a parallel proceeding not produce preclusive facts or claim bar. A court can do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, parties get a chance to argue it, which didn't happen here. But if she had done that, that would be a theoretical problem for the appellants. But you're pointing out that it wasn't a bifurcation order at all.
If she had done that, Your Honor, we obviously wouldn't be here, at least on that issue. I agree. She did not. She allowed the contract claim to continue, however. And she took the equitable claims that were filed in the original complaint, and sent them to the rule to show cause.
She didn't send them anywhere. She just informally stayed her breach of contract action while some other action was prosecuted.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, we would disagree that the contract action was stayed. She ordered that that was continued. And she did order the wife to file a rule to show cause. And I'm not sure I agree with appellants that if we hadn't gone ahead and done what she
ordered them to file a show cause?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
There was an order to file a show cause?
Yes, Your Honor. We could turn to the joint appendix. I believe it's ordered in...
Looking at page 84, I would assume, counsel, where in there does she order that they file a show cause? She says, appearing that a rule to show cause in the divorce proceeding would be a proper vehicle.
It is further ordered, on page 85, it's further ordered that plaintiff shall file a petition for a rule to show cause within 30 days.
Well, that's giving you a time to file it should you choose to file one.
It's certainly given us that time, Your Honor, but we've also read that as being ordered by the court to show file a rule to show cause. I think in abundance of caution that was the right thing to do. If I may continue, Your Honor.
Let's get back to the subject matter jurisdiction issue that you raised. In your rule to show cause, you asked the court to do a number of things, A through L, in the pleading.
Yes, ma'am.
And in order for her to determine whether you were entitled to have her do these things, did she not have to indeed determine whether the contract had even been violated in that respect and or whether the actions had been taken?
She had to determine whether the term sheet had been willfully violated by the defendant.
Therefore, she would have to determine whether, for example, if you ask that the assistance benefits be paid, she would have to determine whether they were required to be paid and if they had been paid.
She would have to determine, Your Honor, whether the term sheet called for that and whether that had been done. Yes, Your Honor.
And so in finding that that had been done, she would make a finding of fact that the benefits have been paid.
She would make a finding of fact, yes, ma'am.
And so why would that not bind the subsequent contract action? That finding of fact be binding in the subsequent contract action?
Well, Your Honor, we had argued in Ray's subject matter jurisdiction that this simply went beyond the subject matter jurisdiction of a rule to show cause hearing. That was our argument there. Turning from subject matter jurisdiction, we also look to this court.
Before you turn from that, I'm just really finding it hard to comprehend this. You have a show cause that has as its subject whether or not this agreement had been breached. Are you suggesting that you could have told, or anybody could have told the trial judge, I'm sorry, you can't decide that question. You don't have subject matter jurisdiction. Are you suggesting that for real?
No, Your Honor. We are suggesting that the court went beyond that which they should have given the pending contract action, that was reserved for the contract action, that it couldn't be fully litigated within that action. That's our argument, Your Honor.
And, you know, well, how could it be not litigated with it? How could you find somebody in contempt or not in contempt without deciding the underlying question of whether or not there was a contract that was breached? How could you do that?
Your Honor,
it'd be real hard.
If the contract was clear on its face and there was a willful violation, then...
Now, willfulness is separate. Right?
Yes, sure.
And if this, as I think Justice Kelsey pointed out earlier, if this trial judge had said, well, I don't know whether it was breached or not, but if it had been, I didn't find it to be willful, different case.
Yes, sir.
But there are findings in here that this contract was breached, and I don't find that it was willful in any event. Now, that's the case we have. I just don't understand how a party can bring a case that has at the heart of it an issue, and the party that brings it then tells the judge, you don't have subject matter jurisdiction to decide the issue we have brought to you. I just don't understand this. Maybe you could help.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court has made a strong point on that, and that we might be here for a while. then I'm not sure. I'm not sure I have a great answer for the Chief Judge on that other than what I have put forth.
Okay.
We would, however, Your Honor, say that as to SHC, who Judge Brody said was not a party to this contract, it is a different matter. And that gets us back to Your Honor's first question, I believe, regarding privity.
Have you seen a case anywhere in the United States that says that a sole shareholder who is the only officer of a closely held corporation is not in privity with the corporation? Because there's a restatement provision pretty much on point saying, well, that's the paradigm case for privity.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there is a case that, and I believe this court has stated there is not cases that way. However, they did take opposing stances on that early on, that SHC had no duties underneath this term sheet, even though we sued on it, Your Honor. They were saying they did not have duties under the term sheet. So that's why we proceeded. So, if I may continue, Your Honor. Assuming that there was subject matter jurisdiction, assuming that the court had a right to decide on the contract, we would go back to the issue that this court revisited and looked at in Griever Corp v. Tazewell. And we understand that this court did not extend it in that case where we had an issue of bankruptcy where there was an express reservation of a plaintiff's right there regarding some bankruptcy plans, but we believe that the judicial order exception is appropriate for what is an unusual.
And the order you're talking about is the non-bifurcation order?
The order I'm talking about is the sending of the equity claims to the original divorce action, yes, Your Honor, to Judge Brody. That's what I'm discussing. And the continuation of the contract claim with an invitation to plaintiffs to amend. We would say that this is an opportunity for the court to extend it to this. And I believe I am out of time.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Keith, you have 2 minutes and 40 seconds if you deem it appropriate to use it.
Just a couple of points, Your Honor. First of all, just back to this business, we did, in fact, plead that SHC had no responsibility in this matter. We withdrew that point formally at the argument on the demur for the first time, and then later during the trial stipulated that to the contrary. So. It simply didn't make any sense to argue otherwise. I would like to address briefly, if I could, the ad damnum point that I didn't get to, and simply that Rule 3:2(c)(2), a relatively new addition to the rule of the Supreme Court, which requires that any complaint requesting an award of money damages contain an ad damnum clause stating the amount of damages sought. It seems to me that the colloquy between counsel and the trial judge is a bit tortured, but if you read it carefully, I believe that the judge denied the motion to amend because it was unnecessary.
But it seems he did that not based on the presence or absence of an ad damnum figure, but the presence or absence of analogous factual allegations.
That's correct. It was more like a motion to complete conform the pleadings to the proof. And I tried to press him on that to try to understand whether we had a number in the ad damnum or not. And finally, when at the end of the colloquy, he said, "You're too late." And that vitiates the rule. The rule, I mean, as the court ruled, it basically puts the burden on the defendant to raise this and to raise it before trial. If you raise it when it was raised in this case, it was too late, and that's simply not the rule. And this is a rule that the practicing bar needs, and we need it to be enforced, and it'll only take one time. And so I think that I would urge the court to act on that.
Mr. Keith, I'm sorry. Did you say you thought the judge denied the motion to amend?
Yes, I think he said a couple of different things, I'll grant you, but he said basically that the amendment was not necessary. He said, but if it were necessary, then I'd be entitled to grant it. But he used the condition contrary to fact.
Okay.
But just to make it clear, you want us to rule that it was precluded in the first instance and then give you an advisory opinion on the addendum.
Correct. Thank you very much.
The court will just take a short recess.
All right.